Okay, let's get started. I want to start in 2 Kings chapter 15. We looked last week at King Uzziah. Some translations give his name as Azariah. We ended a discussion last week with him, so I want to look at the king that followed him. You'll find this in chapter 15 of 2 Kings, verse 32. And it's just the few verses until the end of the chapter. How old was he when he came to the throne?
25.
How old was he when he came to the throne?
25.
How long did he reign?
16.
Presumably he died then. That typically is the way your reign ends. So how old was he when he died? That doesn't seem all that old anymore. How old was Mrs. Kirkland?
50 or 60.
40 or 50 is because when you're
12,
they're just old, and you can't tell the difference, can you? If they're 30, they're just as old as if they're 60. That rang very true. He had no idea how old she was.
Okay.
What's the judgment on this guy? Jotham is his name. What's the judgment on him?
Did what was right.
Did what was right.
In the eyes of the Messiah.
He did well, except
the
places where people were worshiping false gods, he had the power to take them down, and he didn't do it. Okay. What else does it say about him? It says just a little bit at the end of verse 35. He had some building projects, at least one. And that's about all you get, right? What is our practice at this point? We put a bookmark there. We flip over to 2 Chronicles. And he gets the whole of chapter 27. Now, 27 is one of the shorter chapters that you'll find. It's only 9 verses long, so a whole chapter is not all that much. I will warn you that I got some of this out of order in the first hour, and we got confused, which made everybody laugh because Norman had said in our hour that he refused to be confused. And I said the confusion has infused and defused to the point that it can't be refused. So maybe we won't get confused this time. Chapter 27. The judgment is the same. 25 years, reign for 16 years. Gives his mother's name. Verse 2, he did what the Lord regarded as right. Doesn't say anything about not tearing down the places of false worship. But in place of that, what does it say?
He did not enter the temple of the Lord.
Well, Uzziah did, and that's what got him leprosy, if you remember last time. He's saying he didn't do what Uzziah did, which was to cross that line of trying to be a priest. But then it says something else. It doesn't say he didn't tear down all the places of worship. What does it say? The people, mine says, continued to do wrong. Does yours use the word continued?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the picture is he wasn't participating in it, but he didn't stop them. And they didn't stop themselves. If you take a look at verses 3 and 4, there's a little bit more in the way of building projects. It's not just the upper gate of the temple, but it also talks about walls, presumably a city wall someplace, and then it talks about building fortifications and towns that would guard the borders or guard the countryside. Verse 5, he had a war with the people of Ammon, the king of Ammon, the Ammonites. Who started that war?
Says he did.
I've been watching a lot of basketball the last few days. I don't like the way the rules are written. I think if somebody's got the ball, he drops his shoulder and he plows his shoulder into the chest of some poor guy that's sitting there, it ought to be a foul on the guy who plowed his chest in, the one that initiates the contact. But somehow, that's not the way basketball works. It does sound like he initiated the contact. There's no context, so we don't know what was going on that did this. But it did look like that it worked, that he was successful in this. And there's a fascinating sentence in verse 6. Mine has three words. Jotham became powerful, followed by the word because. The historian under God's inspiration is giving you insight into not what happened, but what happened and why it happened. What was the reason that Jotham became powerful?
Walked steadfastly before the Lord.
Mine says he kept an unswerving course before the Lord. Yours said he walked, I think one translation said walked a steadfast path, which says yours has some of those words but not lined up quite the same way.
Mine says he ordered his ways.
Yeah. The choir sings a song which you likely will never hear. And the recurring phrase in it is, order my steps, Lord, order my steps. That's coming out of this verse, I think. Order my steps in your word, order my steps in the work that I do, order my steps. Some of that's there. Now, you have to have been part of this group for 4 or 5 years, maybe longer. But a long time ago, we took a look at the comment Jesus made, broad is the gate, wide is the way that leads to destruction. Narrow is the gate, narrow is the way that leads to life. And very few people find it. We talked about that. And when we talked about it, I made the assertion, I do believe it's true, that most people who think about this think if you're thinking about a narrow pathway, you're thinking about a cliff wall, a little path has been carved out of the cliff wall, and you're in great danger of falling off, that's the picture that you have. Okay? But more in line with Hannah, I think of this more as a balance beam. What is it? 4 inches wide, 6 inches wide? Right. And if you're on a balance beam, which way do you fall off?
Either way.
Could be either way. And what we did was we walked through. I'm just going to give you just the little summary of it. It's back in the file someplace. The summary of it is that you have a tendency, because I'm a sinner and you're a sinner, we have a tendency to fall off of that narrow way in a certain way. But if we don't, Satan has a nature of pushing us off in the other way. If we don't do this of our own accord, Satan comes along and tries to. So if we don't fall into sin, then Satan tries to push us into arrogance towards those who do fall into sin. And either way you fall. That picture of a narrow way, and I think something like that probably is here. That he could have gone wrong this way or that way, and somehow he's found that narrow path. And I hear an echo of some of those things we talked about. Okay? A little bit bigger discussion here. What I find when I look between 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles for things like this is that when you get to 2 Chronicles, it sort of gives you a reminder of what 2 Kings said, and then picks a place or two and amplifies that. So that's the spirit I'd like to do. Now, right here is where I made the mistake in the first hour. I kept going. Don't want to keep going. I want to put the bookmark back. I want to go back to 2 Kings because I want to do the more concentrated, the more quick version first. Okay? Chapter 16 talks about the reign of Ahaz, who's Jotham's son. How did Jotham do? What was the judgment of Jotham? Did pretty good. He didn't do everything perfect, so he gets a squiggle instead of a capital P, but he was still pretty good. How was Ahaz? I'm looking at the tail end of verse 2.
He did not do right.
Yeah, he got a D. Now, before you go too far, let me back up to the first part of verse 2. How old was he when he came to the throne?
20.
And how long did he reign? How old was he when he died, assuming that's what ended his reign? 36. These people aren't lasting very long. Okay? Now, if I take a look, it says at the end of verse 2, he didn't do what the Lord his God regarded as right, as his ancestor David had done, and then it begins to give you details. He followed the example of who? Whose example did he follow? The kings of Israel. Now, pause for just a minute. Judah is the name for the southern kingdom, which is Judah, and maybe a little bit of Benjamin, and maybe a little bit of a couple of others, but it's primarily Judah. And the northern kingdom was the one that retained the name Israel. So when it says kings of Israel, it's the kings that are up there. What would their name have been for themselves? What was their capital city? Samaria, and therefore Samaritans later on. although that gets pretty complicated too. So he was following the lead of the kings of Israel, even to the point of what? Sacrificing his son by burning his son to death. And then it goes on to say, also copying the practices of
the nations.
Which nations?
Detestable ways.
Norman talked about Abram coming into Canaan. All kinds of people there. When Joshua brought the people back in, God was displacing those people. And part of the justification for that, I don't know from our sensibility in our time whether that justification holds up in our eyes, but I have a sense that the only way to think about this is cancer. If you don't get it all, you're going to have problems coming back. And I don't know that I like that very much, but I think that's the one metaphor that works, because otherwise it sure sounds like genocide. But these nations had been displaced, but not perfectly. Remember, the people didn't do all the things God said, so some of them were still left. So he's, if you look carefully, I see bookends. Do you see bookends? On this side, he's following the practice of the kings of Israel. On this side, he's following the practice of the people that had originally been in the land. And between those two, he's doing everything he could possibly do. I see something interesting. I don't know if it works. I see Jotham following a defined path that was narrow and a little hard to follow. I see him as sort of saying, the one place I'm not going to go is where God wants me. I'm going to go this way. I'm going to go this way. Somehow I see that. And it not only says, not only did he not tear down the places that people were making false worship, it says he went there and led the way. Okay? We doing all right? So, verse 5, it was at this point that the king of Aram, what's Aram? That is modern day Syria, capital, Damascus, where? North and
east.
Away from the Mediterranean Sea. I have to turn around before I can see it correctly. Because if I try doing it here, it's backwards for you. That's something I've learned in class. You can't do things this way. Yeah. The king of Aram and also who? One of the kings of Israel. Launched their campaign against Jerusalem. They besieged it but could not reduce it. And about the same time, the king of Edom was coming in from where? Where was Edom? Edom was to the southeast. He's coming in from the southeast and attacking and taking back some of the land that was there. Verse 7, so what did Ahaz do? But you've already read this, so you can speed up here if you like.
He's trying to strike a deal with the Assyrians.
He said, hey, there's a big power that's a little further away. I'm going to strike a deal with him. He went to
Tiglath-Pileser.
It's not Pilsner. I've heard that word somewhere. I've never had one anywhere close by, but I've heard that word somewhere in my life. Pileser, king of Assyria, and said, I'm your servant, your son. Come and rescue me from who? The king of Aram, the king of Israel, who are making war on me. And he took everything he could find. He took the gold and the silver that was in the temple, as well as the gold and silver in his own treasuries, and sent it to the king of Assyria. And what was the king of Assyria's response? Verse 9. He came in and attacked Damascus and captured it, deported its population, put the king that had been attacking them to death. That sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah, real quick question.
Yeah.
My translation says, I am your servant and vassal. V-A-S-S-E-L. Is that the same thing as a vessel? I am your servant and vessel. What's a vassal?
A vassal is to a king what a serf is to a Cossack. You've got a vassal state is a state that still has some integrity, but they're really controlled by some other power. One might argue Crimea would be described that way today. And Ukraine is fearful that maybe it will be soon. And so is Lithuania and Moldova. Yeah. Okay? So, end of verse 9, how are things with Ahaz?
Pretty good.
Things pretty good. The warring company's pulled away, and And he's grateful and all this kind of stuff. So what does he do in verse 10? He goes to Damascus to say thank you. And while he's in Damascus, what does he see? I'm still in verse 10. Are you still in verse 10? What did he see? He saw an altar. Whose altar was that? Whoever the god of the Assyrians were. Okay? Now he says he saw this altar in Damascus. Interestingly enough, there's more to learn about this, but interestingly enough, who's in control of Damascus at this point? Don't lose this point. This helps you a lot. Who's in control of Damascus?
The Assyrians.
The Assyrians are in control of that. So he may have gone to Damascus, but he's really going to see the Assyrians who came in to help him, so to speak. And he took out his digital camera, and he took out some modeling clay, because mine says he sent both a picture and a model of this altar with details of how to build it. To who?
Uriah.
To the high priest who's back in Jerusalem. And verse 11 says the high priest did what? He built him one using the instructions sent by King Ahaz from Damascus. And he finished before King Ahaz got back. And as soon as King Ahaz got back, what was the first thing he did? It's actually one of the first three things he did. This is verse 12. There's three verbs at the end of that sentence.
He saw it. He presented offerings on it.
Mine says he inspected it. I like that a little better than he saw it. Then it says he approached it. And then it says he ascended it, and the ascending is he ascended it in order to. And then it goes on to say, on the altar he made burnt offerings and oblations. To whom?
Whatever the god was that the altar was for.
Okay, and let's be real careful. Whose god would that be?
The Assyrians.
Probably the Assyrians. It was located in Damascus, but he's probably talking about the gods of Assyria, because they're the ones who just destroyed Assyria.
So the implication that the altar was built by the Assyrians after they captured Damascus.
Well, I'm suggesting that that's what it was. It could have been the people in Damascus had already built a model of the one that was wherever Assyria was. The picture I have, it was probably an Assyrian one. And I've got that picture for a very special reason, but I'll show you that reason in a little while. Okay, what happened to the altar to the Lord that used to stand there? Verse 14.
He moved it.
Mine says he removed it, and removing it means he moved it someplace else.
Right. So the King James says put it on the north side of the altar.
Put it on the... And then he said in verse 15... Ignore that altar, start doing everything here. What happened to the bronze altar at the tail end of verse 15? I'll take care of that, he says.
God says he will be only for my personal use, which is a very different way.
That is a different way. Verse 17, what do you do with the rest of the equipment? Broke it up, moved it, put it out of the way. Sort of threw it all to the side. Verse 18, and from the temple of the Lord, in deference to the king of Assyria. That's why, Judy, I think it's an Assyrian altar, an altar to Assyrian gods. In deference to the king of Assyria, he removed the dais for the throne which had been built inside and the royal entrance on the outside. And then that's all you see. Verse 19, he dies and his son takes over. Who's his son?
Hezekiah.
So what have you seen so far? I don't even need an answer. I just want you to sort of go back through it. Okay? What are we going to do now? Put a bookmark there. Flip ourselves over to 2 Chronicles. And we're going to go to 2 Chronicles chapter 28. And this chapter is a little bit longer. Remember what 2 Chronicles does? Gives a little different view. One of the things that I think probably we ought to remind ourselves in here somewhere is eyewitness testimony sometimes can differ in details and sometimes can differ in more than details. And still, that's what the eyewitnesses report. And somewhere in here, I think we just have to think about that for a second. I won't dwell on that. Verse 1, how old was he? How long did he reign? Same thing as what we saw before. End of verse 1, what was the judgment? Didn't do very well. Verse 2 and 3 and 4, it tells what he did, but boy, it goes into more detail of all the things he did.
I'm concerned that he sacrificed his sons in the fire.
It's plural. It's plural
more
this time.
One.
It's
yeah,
plural this
more
time.
Than last time.
Yeah.
Made metal images of
yeah.
balls.
Yeah. I've always called them bales, but that may be because I'm from East Tennessee. What's the first word in chapter 28, verse 5? Second Chronicles, chapter 28, verse 5. What's the first word?
Therefore.
Yours is therefore. My word is so. What does that mean? Let me give you a little tip. This is an absolute, ugly, awful cliche, but if you don't know it, you need it. Somebody said a long time ago, when you're trying to read the Bible and you come across a therefore, you always want to know what the therefore is there for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? What's it there for? It's pointing you back to saying, Ahaz has been doing all these things, and there's a consequence. And what's the consequence?
God handed him over to the king of Aram.
God put him at the mercy. So that attack from Aram was actually directed by God, who defeated him and took away large numbers of captives. Where did he carry them?
Damascus.
And I'm still in verse 5. What else did God do? Put him at the mercy of the king of Israel, who inflicted heavy casualties on him. Verse 6 tells you how heavy the casualties were. How many people died?
120,000.
All of them prominent men of Judah. And they died because, I'm still in the middle of verse 6, they died because they had abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors. It says in verse 7 that a particular champion of Ephraim is one of the tribes of Israel, that's part of, it's one of the sections of the northern kingdom, killed one of the king's sons, killed the controller of the household, and killed the king's second in command. 2 Chronicles 28, end of verse 7. 2 Chronicles 28, end of verse 7. Verse 8 in my translation starts out like this. Now, wait a minute. Aram has already done its thing. That was up early in verse 5. Now we move to what the king of Israel is doing. The king of Israel is all the way down to here. Verse 8. Of their brothers, the soldiers of Israel took captives. How many? 200,000. Including women and children. They also took quantities of, yours says plunder, mine says booty. I'm going to go by plunder because booty has gotten a bad name in our day. Carting everything off to Samaria. Carting off the people to be what?
Slaves
almost certainly, and carrying off the plunder. Right? So far, this is a little different from what you've seen. But it's pretty close until you get to verse 9. Mine says, there was a prophet of the Lord there. Where is there? Well, if it's Samaria, or if it's Judah, I don't know. I think yours may say a prophet from Samaria, but mine doesn't say exactly where he's from. I think they're in Judah getting ready to head back north. There was a prophet of the Lord there. What was his name?
Obed.
I want to say Obed. Why do I want to say Obed? Because there's an ancestor of David that has the name Obed, but that B is turned the wrong way. It's turned backwards. This is Oded, and it's not dead in the sense of, oh, dead. It's just O-D-E-D. Okay? How many prophets?
One.
How many captives? 200,000. How many soldiers to control 200,000 captives? Probably at least 100,000. There's a whole bunch of people. How many prophets?
One.
And what does that prophet do? He stands up and basically says, you are doing evil. It's bad enough that you've attacked your brothers. This is a civil war. This is a civil war. They are all children of Israel. It's bad enough that you've attacked them. You're about to carry them away in slavery. You're about to compound the sin that you've already committed. You should not do this. What's happened to other prophets who had the temerity to do this? They've been pushed away or killed. What happens to this one? Verse 11. Listen to me. Release the captives you have taken from among your brothers, for the fierce anger of the Lord hangs over you. Verse 12. What happens? Mine describes them as chieftains from that same province of Ephraim. And it names them. protested to those that were returning from the war and said to them, you can't bring the captives here, for we've already sinned against the Lord, and you propose to add to that sin and guilt, even though our guilt is already great and fierce anger is hanging over Israel. And so in the presence of the officials and the whole assembly, the soldiers gave up the captives and the plunder. Men nominated for the purpose took charge of the captives. From the plunder, they found clothing for all of those who were naked. How many were naked? Starts with M. Either many or most. And sandals, it says. Gave them clothing and sandals. They were barefoot. You remember that awful scene in the middle of Schindler's List? Naked and barefoot. Provided them with food and drink, put on donkeys all of those who were infirm, and did what?
Took
them back to the palm trees of Jericho, to their brothers. And then they came back to Samaria. That's almost unbelievable. One prophet stopped something awful. Verse 16, this was when King Ahaz sent to the king of Assyria to come to his assistance. It was in the middle of this. The attackers are Aram and the king of Israel, and he sent them to come to his assistance. About the same time, the Edomites were coming. Now, we saw that in the other place, right? They're coming in from the south. Verse 19, the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, since he behaved without restraint in Judah. Verse 20, what does it say? It's not so much the king of Assyria coming in to help. Back there they said, he gave him all the silver and gold from the temple and from the treasury, and he came in and helped a little bit. Not here. What's happening? Mine says he attacked and besieged him, but he could not overpower him. That's a little different. Back in Kings, it was the king of Aram who was doing that. Now, they had just destroyed the king of Aram in the Second Kings account, and so the attack was certainly coming from that direction. I don't know if that's the way you reconcile these things. Ahaz robbed the temple of the Lord and the palaces of the king and the princes, gave everything to the king of Assyria, but he still received no help from him. And during the time he was under siege, he disobeyed the Lord even more grossly, this King Ahaz.
That says he collapsed spiritually.
That just about says it, doesn't it? Instead of saying, heavens, my only hope is to return to the Lord, it got even worse. Now watch what he does. This isn't in 2 Kings. He offered sacrifices to the gods of Damascus who had defeated him. Now, I think that was the gods of Assyria that had been planted in Damascus, but never mind. The gods of the kings of Aram have supported them. I'll sacrifice to them. Maybe they'll help me. But they proved to be his and Israel's downfall. Verse 24, what did he do?
Cut up all the vessels of the house of the Lord.
All the equipment for worship that was in the temple. Cut it all up. And then?
Close the door.
Yeah, yours says closed.
Shut up.
Yours says nailed it shut. Mine says sealed it shut. You need one of those second two words.
Shut up the doors.
Sealed them. Nailed them shut. Nobody's ever going to use that temple again. And instead set up his own altars in every corner of Jerusalem, and then set up high places in every town of Judah to burn incense to other gods. And listen how this ends. It's chilling. Thus provoking the anger of the Lord, the God of his ancestors. That's about the third or fourth time that phrase has been used. And he dies, and who succeeds him?
Hezekiah.
Right? What do we have to do?
Back.
Put our bookmark in. Jump back to 2 Kings. So where do we jump back to? We left off at the last verse of chapter 16. And then we look at chapter 17, and we don't find anything about Ahaz. This is what I directed you to last week. This is the story of the end of the northern kingdom as the Assyrians came in. And the rest of the chapter, everything in chapter 17, starting about verse 7, the rest of it gives you all of the reasons for the downfall of the northern kingdom. Over and over again, it says, they did this and that caused God's anger. They did that and that brought these consequences. We talked about that last week. I just commend that to you. I will tell you, though, that hiding in this little section is one more thing, and since I mentioned it in the first hour, I'll mention it in here as well. You've read chapter 17, right? That was your assignment. Denise, you may not have known that, but the rest of you did. Right? So you've read this already, right? When the king of Israel, of Assyria, overran the northern kingdom, besieged Samaria and broke it, what did he do with the people? He took most of them and moved them a long way away. And what did he do then? Oh, come on, you remember this from last week. He took people from a long way away and moved them in. This is chapter 17. Verse 24, the king of Israel, this is chapter 17 of 2 Kings, verse 24, the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Kattah, Avah, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in the towns of Samaria to replace the Israelites. And these took possession of Samaria and lived in its towns. That's the northern kingdom. When they first came to live there, they did not worship the Lord. And what did the Lord do?
He sent lions.
Plural. Lots of lions. Consequently, the king of Assyria was informed, the nations whom you deported and settled in the towns of Samaria, and I'm quoting, do not know how to worship the local god, and he has set lions on them. And now the lions are killing them because they don't know how to worship the local god. So the king of Assyria gave this order, send back one of the priests whom I deported from there. Let him go live there and teach them how to worship the local god. If you read the next few verses, he went back, taught them how to do the rituals, and they began to worship false gods and worship God, to go through the rituals of worship side by side. Can you see where some of the attitudes toward the Samaritans might have come from in Jesus' time? These were people who weren't really from there, but who had learned some kind of worship way back when. This is the source of some of that. Going through the motions is very different from actually worshiping. And that's a piece that's here. So, chapter 18 is where we start with this next part. Because we're starting on who?
Hezekiah.
Okay? So let's see how this starts. How old was he when he came to the throne? 25. How long did he reign?
29.
So how old was he when his reign ended and presumably when he died? Let's see your math skills.
54.
Very good. You did well. What's the judgment?
He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done.
He compares all the way back to David. Okay? And what's the first thing it says in the next verse?
You removed the high place.
For the first time, we've got one who's breaking down the places where the false worship was going on. Okay? Now, I want to pause for a minute and do something that I forgot to do in the first hour. Let's go back to Uzziah. Uzziah was judged to have done really well as long as what?
He was alive.
As long as there was a priest, advisor, mentor, as long as he was alive. Everybody did well. What was that guy's name? The guy's name was Zechariah. Who's Hezekiah's mama? Tail end of verse 2. Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. A couple of people in the first hour, I forgot to talk about this in the first hour, a couple of people came and said, I wonder whether the reason they're telling us about the mothers is that hiding in there is something like what happened to Timothy. I know that you learned from your mother and from your grandmother, and maybe something like that is what we're supposed to. I don't know enough to know, but I do think that's very interesting. Zechariah seems to have been the last sort of voice of reason back there, and maybe somewhere in there the influence of his mother is coming back. Because there's a pattern, if you watch, that you have a really good one and it's followed by a really bad one and that's followed by another really good one. It doesn't always work exactly like that, but it's almost like you got a sine wave going on if you know something about engineering. And Hezekiah is a good one. Okay? Look down to verse 5. I'm going to come back to verse 4 in a minute. Come back down to verse 5. How does it start? He put his trust in the Lord, the God of Israel. No king of Judah after him could be compared with him, nor any of the kings before him. Does it say king of Israel?
Judah.
So if you just look at the ones who were kings of the southern kingdom, that would start with Rehoboam and come to here. Not a one like him. He's the best of all of those. Verse 6, he was devoted to the Lord, never turning from him, but keeping the commandments which the Lord had laid down for Moses. That means he had to have known what those commandments were. And not all the kings seem to have known that. And therefore God was with him, and he was successful in all that he undertook. Look at verse 7. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and refused to serve him. He beat the Philistines all the way back to Gaza, laying their territory waste from watchtown to fortified town. Now, take one more look at verse 4. In addition to knocking down all the false worship places, what else did he do?
Broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses had made. For up to that time, the Israelites had been burning incense to it.
The bronze snake that Moses had made? They called it Nehushta. Is that right? They called it Nehushta. You may know better than I what that means. It turns out to mean snake.
Nehushta.
Nehushta. Yeah, that's what they said. It means snake and sounds close to a couple of words that mean some other things that kind of hint at this. Where was the story of the bronze serpent of Moses? Oh, yeah. Numbers 21. You all knew that, right?
Yeah.
Numbers 21. The heart of that story is verse 4 through 9. What had happened? The people had been so rebellious, God had sent fiery serpents. We don't know exactly what that means. Among the people, they would bite the people would die. And Moses prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said, okay, make a serpent out of bronze, lift it up on a stick, people look at the serpent, they live. So far, okay? Jesus, speaking to Nicodemus in the evening, centuries later, said something really important. What did he say? Just like that serpent was lifted up, in that same way, I'm going to be lifted up. And when I'm lifted up, all those who look to me will live. Now, what's happened? People are worshiping. People are worshiping. That's a nice sound you got there. People are, listen carefully, people are worshiping the object lesson that God has given them. God has given them a model of what's coming. Jesus is coming, is going to do this for the whole world spiritually. This thing is doing it for this people physically. And instead of recognizing this is pointing me towards the Lord, they start worshiping the object. You have a church where the people worship a pastor. I've seen a church like that. It's not pretty. As opposed to worshiping the God that the people have gathered to worship. I thought the most important thing Norman said today was about Mrs. Kirkland. And I thought he didn't realize how close he came to one of the big things I was going to be talking about. Norman realized he had been worshiping Mrs. Kirkland. He had meant to. He knew what he was there for. That's what happened. And Hezekiah saw this, saw it for what it was, and destroyed the object of worship. It had survived this long. And nobody had ever mentioned it. This is fascinating. Now, interestingly enough, this is where we ran out of time in the first hour. So guess what? This is where we're going to run out of time now.
So Bill, this has been about how many years since Moses and the people in the wilderness? This has been a long time.
Probably 1200 BC for that one, and probably 700 BC for this, maybe 500 years. I don't know if I have the times exactly right. It's been a long time. I heard Jim Pardue say something that I think is the most important thing I've ever heard a preacher say. If you walk out of worship service and you look back and you say, boy, Pardue's a great preacher, he said, I have failed in everything I've tried to do. If you walk out and say, my goodness, my God is a great God, then I've succeeded.
Remember, he used to ask people when they'd say it was a good message, trying to be nice, and he would say, what'd you get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. And I thought that's one of the most important things that he did when he was here, was to say, be really careful. Don't start praising the one who's brought you the message. Praise the God the message has revealed. Really important. And this, more than any, this one little bitty verse, half a verse, just kind of hidden away here, you get a glimpse of something really, really big. Comment. We've been in the swamp for several weeks, right? We're out of the swamp now. There's big stuff everywhere we look. And there's a whole lot of big stuff coming for Hezekiah. A whole lot of big stuff coming out of what we see for Hezekiah. 2 Kings does not bring it out, in my opinion. So we're going to go look at more of this in 2 Kings, sort of get the lay of the land. Then we're going to come back to Chronicles. And when we come back to Chronicles, we're going to see all that stuff, and the context is going to be so different, radically different. It's nothing changes, but the context of how you see it changes. That's what the chronicler is doing. And when you see that, you see something that I think applies to a lot of people, and that applies to several people who are in this room right now. You've got to wait till we come back together before we can do this. But there is something huge in what's coming in the next little bit. So, what's your assignment? Right? Start in chapter 18 in 2 Kings, and start in chapter 29 in 2 Chronicles, and read until you get tired. Read until you get tired. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Father, we learn from the story of Oded how much a single person can do when that person is led by you to confront the wickedness of his day. We realize as we read 2 Kings 17 that over and over again you sent prophets to the people of Israel and to the people of Judah that mostly were ignored. And we realize that today we need to hear your word as well. And so, if you're sending prophets, which I believe you are, help us be sensitive enough to where we can recognize them when we hear them. If you send us leaders who are tuned in to you, help us recognize them so that we can get in line with them and maybe make a difference in the world that needs you so much. I pray my thanks that you do raise up prophets and leaders who do hear you and who do respond in ways that you approve. And I pray that to the extent that we are leaders and to the extent that you give us a word to speak, that we could be worthy of that and speak with confidence in you and with humility for us. For I pray this in your Son's name. Amen.